Welcome to Global Journalist on KBIA. This is the program that says mid-Missourians, indeed many Americans, are interested in international news. I'm Stuart Laurie of the Missouri School of Journalism. For more than 2 months now, we have been dealing with a story of epic and tragic proportions for the American people and those of the Muslim world. When will it all end? Well, we just don't know. But today is a day of Thanksgiving, a day in which the American people generally celebrate and give thanks for all that has been good for them in the past year. I thought it would be a good idea on this Thanksgiving to find out how American journalists living abroad celebrate the holiday, what they feel they can give thanks for, and what, if the countries they are living in had a Thanksgiving holiday, those countries would give thanks for. And finally, I will ask them how they see the United States from abroad. From their vantage points, does America have much to give thanks for today? Our guests are, in London, Warren Hoag, the Bureau Chief of the New York Times. In Moscow, Jill Doherty, Bureau Chief of CNN. In Cairo, Abdallah Schleifer, former NBC Bureau Chief there and now Director of the Adham Center for Television Journalism at the American University in Cairo. And in Buenos Aires, David Lunau, a Mexico correspondent for the Wall Street Journal on assignment to cover the crisis, the economic crisis in Argentina. Actually, let's start with my last question first. Warren Hoag, from your vantage point, does the United States have much to give thanks for today?
That's a difficult question given the things that have happened in the United States in the last couple of months. I suppose one thing you can be thankful for as an American in the United States is the focus that the horrific events of September 11th have brought to our sense of ourselves, in the larger world, and what the rest of the world thinks about us and what we may have to do to persuade them that we may not be the people they think we are. I think the most important thing in all that is that I get the impression, as an American living abroad, that more Americans have an interest in the world than they did before September 11th. It is horrible to think that it took the events like those of September 11th to produce that result, but I think in sort of a perverse way that that is something we can be thankful for.
And Jill Doherty, let's go around the horn, and why don't you go on that same question?
Well, I think for Americans who are living in the United States, there's some basic things that they can be thankful for in spite of those tragic events. And just thinking about Afghanistan and that entire region, it's a destitute area with extremely poor people, no water, horrible diseases. And the United States, you know, when you come, in fact, last year I was in Tajikistan and then went back to the States, and it is shocking the different level of existence that people have. Americans, I think, sometimes don't realize how well physically they live, that they have health care, they have clean water, food, and some basic things that people in Central Asia can't even dream about. So I'd have to say, just on a very basic level, Americans are extremely privileged to live the way they do.
And Abdallah Schleifer, what do you say?
I think after 9/11, and that's what we're really, some of us are talking about, there was a rebirth of a sense of older virtues that has sort of disappeared, particularly in the 90s. You know, maybe they started disappearing in the 60s and 70s and 80s, but certainly in the 90s. And I'm talking about something as simple as heroism. When I was a kid, as a young kid, I wanted to be a fireman or a policeman. But those ambitions on virtue and a sense of heroism and sacrifice and community and putting community first disappeared. I mean, kids want to grow up and be rap stars or MTV dancers or whatever. And the terrible events have changed that.
And David Lunau from Buenos Aires.
Well, from my view, I've spent most of my life outside the U.S. I was born to an American family in Mexico and raised in Mexico, and I think working around the region as a journalist has given me a new appreciation for the institutions that the United States has. Latin America's largely had democracies now for the last decade, and they largely haven't worked because they don't have institutions that work, that underpin those democracies. Their judiciaries aren't very effective. Their law enforcement isn't effective. The law is applied unevenly. Competition laws aren't enforced. So I don't think the average citizen really feels like they've gotten much of a benefit yet from open markets and from democracy. And this is where the where they're really going to need to work hard in the next few decades in the region and probably in other places like Russia, where Joe is really getting these kinds of U.S.-style institutions that work and are transparent, so people feel like they have a stake in things and are a part of things. It's something that America has that really works well that I think we all take for granted sometimes.
Jill, David raises an interesting question. Do the Russian people see American institutions as a sort of a role model to follow and emulate?
I think some do. The people who are more exposed to life in the West and those institutions, people want courts to work. People want health care to work. And legal protection. There are a lot of things that as he was mentioning, don't function in Russia, and people can't rely upon their government. They can't rely upon the police to protect them from criminals. They can't rely sometimes on insurance. Sometimes, in some cases, it doesn't even exist. So I think if you don't always know what you're missing, but for the people who know that that exists, they certainly would like to see those institutions strengthened.
Well, it sounds like what you're saying is that Americans certainly have much more to give thanks for than the Russian people at this time. Abdullah Schleifer, would that be the same in Egypt? And if so, why?
Well, I even wonder if you can say that about the Russian people. After all, they were delivered a decade or so ago from a monstrous regime, outrageously monstrous regime, and with all the suffering they've undergone since, there are signs just this week, articles have appeared in the International Herald Tribune that certain institutions are starting to click in, and stability is coming in. So I think that sometimes, you know, you thank God not for good things, but relief from terrible things. That's part of it. And certainly, the Russian people were delivered from a terrible system. In Egypt, yes, I think I think that although life is very difficult in Egypt, that people, you know, this is a Muslim country. And the word that is on everybody's lips most of the time, if anything, is Alhamdulillah, which means thanks be to God. And that is, there's an inclination to sense, even if you don't see it, that there has to be some good in whatever's going to happen. And your job in life is to find it. And I think the people have that sense, and to the degree they have that sense, despite all the terrible problems here of poverty and overcrowdedness, this is still a remarkable society in terms of being able to wander the streets of poor neighborhoods late at night and not have to worry about being mugged or beaten up. There's very little of that sort of gratuitous crime in this country despite its social problems. So to the degree that people pursue this idea of thanking for a good they may not even know of, and if they explore it, they'd find that that good is still there.
Warren Hogue, you were telling me before we went on the air that the British people have a good sense of the Thanksgiving holiday, even though they don't celebrate it themselves. Spin that out a little bit and tell us about that.
Well, I've been here 5 years now, Stuart, and it's always struck me that when Thanksgiving comes around, all my British friends start talking about it. Some of them, I think, even celebrate it. I mean, I think they've adopted it for themselves. They don't take a day off from work, but that sort of thing. But the idea of the family meal is something they do here, and they will do it around Thanksgiving time. and they will call it Thanksgiving. I think what I detect in Britain's appreciation of Thanksgiving is the family aspect of it. And I think those Britons that like America, and I think most of them do, find it a very American kind of, heartland, apple pie, flag-waving, it's not militaristic, it is about family, it's about coming together, it's about giving thanks. I think that's the aspect of it that seems to appeal to them. But it is interesting to me that more than any other holiday I can think of, Thanksgiving is the one that seems to be on the mind of Britons. And it is, a profoundly American event. And yet Britons appreciate it almost as if it were their own.
Well, you don't think that the Thanksgiving turkey is ever going to replace the Christmas goose, do you?
I don't think that. No, they would never. I mean, their own traditions are very strong, and I suppose maybe Thanksgiving is something of a reflection of that, since their own traditions also have a lot to do with gathering around a table and, as you say, eating a goose, not a turkey.
Right. Jill Doherty, how are you celebrating Thanksgiving in Moscow?
Well, we're celebrating the way CNN always celebrates, which is we're working. but we will have a turkey as we normally do for lunch. And the Russian people that we work with have gotten used to the idea of Thanksgiving. And in fact, I think they find it pretty charming in a sense, and especially when a lot of the holidays here tend to deal with military victories or some type of political situation. This, as everyone's been saying, is a very personal, family-oriented thing. And when you explain that the whole idea of it is simply to give thanks for your blessings, it's a pretty an amazing holiday. And I must say, personally, I always feel a little more nostalgic about Thanksgiving than almost any other holiday. You know, the Russians celebrate Christmas and New Year's, but missing Thanksgiving sometimes is, I think, quite hard.
Right. Okay. We have to take a break now. This is Global Journalist on KBIA. I'm Stuart Lurie. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Global Journalist. You may listen to this program again, ask questions, or make comments by going to www.globaljournalist.org or by calling us here in Mid-Missouri at 573-882-9641. Abdullah Schleifer, can you tell us whether there will be any Thanksgiving celebration for you and your family in Cairo?
Oh, definitely. The university, the American University where I teach now, closes on Thanksgiving, so I am fortunate in that sense that I'm not working for CNN these days. And we always have a Thanksgiving turkey and cranberry sauce. Sometimes it's hard to get cranberry sauce. I used to have a friend who would get some for me from the embassy supplies, but it's possible now, and we try to do everything. And we also try to invite to our home any Americans we know who don't have family here, so they can join with us in this holiday. And I feel the same way as Jill did. I think it's probably, as someone who's lived abroad so many years, and I have, it's for me the most important holiday there is that I associate with, and I associate it with very strongly. I think it is profoundly an American holiday. It's a holiday in which, every American, no matter when you came to America and the circumstances of coming to America, we all sort of identify with it. We sort of share in a mythic Plymouth Rock, if you would, even if it was Ellis Island and not Plymouth Rock. And so it's an extraordinary, it's a holiday that sort of expresses what some people once referred to as America's civic religion, a religion in which values are shared by everyone, whatever your denomination, and I think it's the perfect expression of that.
David Lunau, I picture all of you in Argentina eating beef for Thanksgiving.
Well, I think the birds are pretty safe down here, but the cows less so. Since I've left family behind in Mexico, I'll be getting together with a few local hacks here and going out for a big parrilla after work. As Jill in Moscow will be working here. We've got pretty much daily news to cover, and they like to go late here, so we'll probably get together and go out. It's always been my favorite holiday too, and something that I've at least tried to celebrate wherever I'm at. Perhaps it's because Abdullah said it's a very uniquely American holiday, and one which I really identify with. I just wish I were in Cairo so he can invite me over to his house.
David, if I can pick up on Stuart's introduction to those comments right now. I lived and worked in Brazil for 5 years, and I used to have a lot of Brazilians coming to our house for Thanksgiving because they don't know how to cook turkey. And I'm a cook, and I remember showing them how you have to put lard across the top of it so it remains moist and doesn't sort of become shoe leather dry. But that was and that carried me on. I then married a woman in Brazil and went on to live in New York. And when her family would come visit us, and it didn't have to be Thanksgiving, they would always insist that I cook them a turkey.
Yeah, if I could move on to a subject that is just a little more serious, and that's conditions around the world. David, in Argentina these days, the country is going through a terrible, terrible economic and political crisis. What are the chances, do you think, that a year from now, the Argentinian people will have something to give thanks for?
That's the problem. I think no one really feels, even the most optimistic cheerleaders of Argentina are kind of few and far between these days. No one really feels like there's much of a chance that the coming year is going to get any better. In the best case, things will probably stay the same. In the worst case, things could really unravel fairly quickly. They've, as you know, for the last decade, they've held to this pretty bold experiment of pegging each peso to the dollar and backing it up with a dollar in the central bank. That's worked for a while, but since the dollar's grown stronger, Argentina's become less of a competitive place around the world, and its economy is now completely stalled. It's got debt that it can't pay, and if it all unravels, it could get ugly. The banking system could collapse, and you could really see a very serious economic depression here. So the famous Argentine ego and bravado is very much gone. I find a country that it's more like Mexico in the sense that it doubts itself and its place in the world. It feels caught between the first world, between the Europe and the United States that it wants to be and maybe was in the past, and neighbors like Brazil and Mexico, which are more low-cost producers for the global economy, and Argentines don't really want to be that either. So they're not quite sure what the future holds, but it doesn't look good at the moment.
Well, you say that the situation could unravel. Does unravel mean the return of perhaps a military government or a totalitarian government of some kind?
I don't think so. You hear a surprising number of people on the street making comments about that, but I don't think even they're very serious when they make them. No one here is under any illusion that a military government would run the economy any better. I think most people have grown used to the fact that they can at least pick their leaders, even if they sometimes don't make the right call. But certainly there will be increasing social pressure over the next year. There's a big workers' march planned for later today, and we'll probably see more and more of this. Your average working wage has fallen about 25% a quarter in nominal terms in the last few years, and that's got to hurt. And it could get a lot worse if this link between the peso and dollar is broken. About 70% of the banking system is in dollars. Everyone has their mortgages in dollars. So the country as a whole may not be able to pay its bills.
Yeah. Abdullah Schleifer, as I read about Egypt, the problems there are of a somewhat different kind these days, and those are political problems. President Mubarak, from what I read, grows more and more isolated from the people, and there is a danger there of a political upheaval. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, that can be exaggerated, but I would say that concern about isolation became more pronounced over the past 2 months, because what happened here was this. Of course, President Mubarak very quickly joined other leaders all through the world in condemning
the terrible actions of September 11th and condemning it without any qualification. And his sense of horror was shared in the streets of Cairo. But then what happened is two things. On one hand, you have the beginning of the bombing runs. And if we recall, the first couple of weeks of those bombing runs in Afghanistan were not directed at the Taliban front lines, which is where I think they should have been from the first place. But they were an attempt to take out increasingly difficult to find targets with smart bombs that every once in a while would go over, fall short or fall long and take out civilians. And that's what the people were seeing on television day after day, civilians, Afghan Muslim civilians being killed. And at the same time, they were very much affected by the Osama bin Laden tape, you know, especially the very first one, which really resonated here with its talk about its allusions to what is deeply felt here, the American double standard, indifference to the suffering that Palestinians have endured for 30 years under occupation, a suffering which every Palestinian Arab believes is the result of terrorism, the terrorism of the occupied territories under occupation and settlement. So these things created a very, very negative and angry mood in the streets. On the other hand, it's an ambiguous mood because Egypt itself suffered terribly from terrorism. Mubarak led a war against domestic terrorists, one of whom became a deputy, two of whom became close deputies to Osama bin Laden because they got out of the country and escaped. So he and the Egyptian people in the end rallied to the government in that war against terrorism because they saw how the terrorism that was being practiced by extremist groups here, fundamentalist groups, involved the death of innocent people, of tourists. It threatened the stability of the society. So on one hand, there was deep anger against America, deep, almost a strange sort of sympathy for Osama bin Laden, but at the same time, ambivalence because they had experienced it themselves. So it was a very unhappy thing, and that's why, once again, President Mubarak is saying the key to stability in the region is to solve the Arab-Israeli conflict. Solve that problem, and that takes away 90% of the bitterness in the Arab streets. The other problems then can be solvable, problems that exist everywhere in the developing world, the problems of the need for a better economic performance. There is privatization going on. Those problems are solvable.
Does President Mubarak see any blame going to the Palestinian or Arab side in the Arab-Israeli conflict? And when he says the key to everything is solving that problem, does he put any of the onus for not solving it on the Palestinians?
Well, I think not really. Because from his point of view, some of the worst things that have happened in the past year, which could be put, which you could put the blame on the Palestinians, namely when someone sets off a bomb, a suicide bomber walks into a pizza parlor and kills 12-year-old kids, that sort of terrorism, which has been practiced, he would say the only reason why it even exists is because of the fact that the inability of the America primarily to bear down and get involved and get a peace settlement in place and to put an end to, because he also would say, violence begins with the imposition of an occupation and a settlement. And to the degree people think that occupation and settlement will end, then they never engaged in that sort of activity. That sort of activity only came about in the last couple of years. You know, when there was a high hope of an Arab-Palestinian settlement, when Rabin and Arafat shook hands on the lawn, and that was followed up with meetings, and the Israelis pulled back from Gaza. I remember this. Two things. One, all of Gaza was happy. They went out on the beaches. They felt, you know, I can't say all of Gaza, because only part of Gaza was did the Israelis pull out of. But that part they pulled out of, the large concentrations of populations. Well, that week, Hamas, which is one of the two groups that staged some of these terrible things, Hamas tried to call a rally. And whereas 2 months earlier they might get 20,000 people to turn out, something like 500 people came out In other words, what I'm saying is that Mubarak would argue, and I think he's right, that Palestinian terrorism is a direct response to a sense of the hopelessness that the whole deck of cards are stacked against them.
Okay.
And let us hope that that situation will change.
Right. Okay. Abdullah, if you don't mind, I would like to go to Jill Dougherty. Jill, the Russians also have what they call a terrorist problem, and that's, of course, in Chechnya. There has been some talk in the last few days of perhaps a breakthrough in Chechnya. Do you see any possibility?
Well, you're right in the sense that for the first time in the last 2 years since the war, the second war, began, they actually had face-to-face negotiations or talks here in Moscow. They didn't yield a whole lot. In fact, the representative, Mr. Kazantsev, said, well, there seems to be a little bit of movement, but we're not hearing anything concrete. And concrete would seem to be they want the Chechen rebels to lay down their arms. But symbolically, at least, and maybe even more than symbolically, this is the first step towards some type of perhaps working something out. But the question is, with whom? Because the person they met with is a representative from the Chechen government, Mr. Maskhadov's government. And that's, if you can use the word, a more moderate faction, certainly than the people like Khattab, who is Jordanian-born, and the Kremlin says is supported by Osama bin Laden. So even if the Kremlin could begin some type of talks with Maskhadov's people, it doesn't mean that Maskhadov at all has any real influence with the other types of rebels, whom the Kremlin would definitely say are terrorists in the mode of Osama bin Laden.
Okay.
So we'll have to see where all of this leads. But certainly Mr. Putin, President Putin, is trying to move ahead on this front. He's been criticized royally in the West for quite a long time on not moving to negotiations. That has been softened certainly since September 11th. But we'll have to see whether something really can come out of it.
Okay,
and also,
Jill.
Of course, Russia would really like to see that happen. They
okay.
have
I'm sorry,
problems.
Jill.
They
I do have to cut you off. Unfortunately, we didn't get to Warren Hoag to talk about terrorism there, but we are out of time. Our guests today have been in London, Warren Hoag; in Moscow, Jill Dougherty; in Cairo, Abdullah Schleifer; and in Buenos Aires, David Lunau. I would like to wish all of you a happy Thanksgiving. Our director is Mary Furness, and our producer, Tianbo Huang. For all, I'm Stuart Laurie, also wishing all of our listeners a happy Thanksgiving. Global Journalist will be back next week.